From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. An investigation is underway into whether Border Patrol agents were part of Facebook posts that came to light this week. The post joked about dead migrants and denigrated Democrats who visited overcrowded border facilities on Monday. Acting Customs and Border Patrol Secretary Kevin McAleenan wrote on Twitter this morning that, quote, any employee found to have compromised the public's trust in our law enforcement mission will be held accountable.
There are also questions being asked today about the military-themed Salute to America celebration President Trump is holding on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial tomorrow. The military isn't allowed to participate in partisan politics. The White House says the evening won't be political, but top aide Kellyanne Conway made comments that indicate otherwise. What would a political strategist advise? Well, let's bring in ours. This week we have Matt Mikowiak, the Republican strategist. Hi, Matt.
Hey there.
And Adrian Elrod, the Democratic strategist. Hi, Adrian.
Good afternoon.
And let's start with the president's replacement 4th on the Mall. He'll give a speech, the only president ever to do that on the 4th, except Truman, whose speech wasn't political. But here's advisor Kellyanne Conway on what will be in Trump's speech.
Thematically, how wonderful this country is, our troops and military, our great democracy, and great call to patriotism, the success of this administration in opening up so many jobs for individuals, what we've done for veterans.
Matt, the success of this administration, I mean, right there, you veer into a whole partisan lane. Does this pass the smell test?
Yeah, I was with her until she started talking about that. Mm-hmm. While I do obviously think they have a good record, I think that's the wrong place to make that case. I would hope this would just be a tribute to the military and to our veterans, to our history. You know, we've been promised it's going to be a non-political message. I certainly hope it is, given the kind of the tradition of this particular event. So I hope they handle it the right way.
But would you have advised this, that a president put himself front and center? I mean, the birthday of the country is supposed to be nonpartisan, and the military is supposed to swear allegiance to the Constitution, not to any party. I mean, you can ask for a tribute to the military without making it about you. Is that possible for this president? And I mean that seriously.
Yeah, I know you do. Look, I think he is. I think in his mind, he sees this as a tribute to the military and connecting, you know, the celebration of the Independence Day with the freedoms that our military has secured for our nation, for our citizens for over 200 years. So, look, he obviously does like making things about himself. He likes being at the center of attention. I really don't think that's what this is about. And again, I won't be in favor of it if it goes into a political, you know, rally type of approach. I think there'll be significant blowback if that's the case. I really don't expect that.
Adrian?
Yeah, with all due respect to my friend Matt, I'm going to disagree with him on this. I mean, look, this is, to your point, unprecedented. We have not seen a president participate in activities around July 4th on the Mall ever. This is a new situation. And of course, we all know that Donald Trump goes off script. This is sort of what he does. He, you know, perhaps, yes, his staff has provided remarks that focus on, you know, the bravery of our military and the freedoms that they have secured for us and Independence Day. But we all know that Trump always goes off script. I'm expecting this to happen. And, you know, we're also seeing, you know, this brigade of military regalia coming onto the Mall, which, of course, is also creating some concerns that the Washington Mall is not equipped to handle the weight of all this equipment. I mean, you know, this is something that authoritarian regimes have done where they have the military come in and celebrate with him. And I think that this is what Donald Trump wants because, you know, he wants to make it feel like this is a day about him when it's really a day about our country.
Matt, I wonder if we can move to the southern border of the U.S. And what you would say as a Republican strategist to the president, if you had his ear, and to lawmakers about the situation there with migrants being held in despicable conditions. These are reports from many different sources. Unaccompanied children in custody for too long. Border agents are apparently facing what the Inspector General for Homeland Security calls a ticking time bomb. What do lawmakers and the president, what more do they need to hear?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's an urgent question. Look, these facilities are temporary facilities, and they're not, you know, some of them are meant to hold 500 people, and they're holding 1,500 or 2,000. And they're meant to hold them for days, not weeks, and certainly not months. So, look, this influx that's coming across the border, is something we're just not prepared to handle. Now, thankfully, Congress did come together right before they took their July 4th break to pass the $4.5 billion request. But that request was waiting for months. Needlessly, I would argue, by the leadership of House Democrats under Speaker Pelosi. The Inspector General report, I think, does add real credibility to some of these claims. Before it, I think some of that was partisan or overstated. But the Inspector General report, I think, does make it clear that there are insufficient living conditions in some of these facilities. Your heart breaks. We need to do better. I know that Congressman Chip Roy, Republican of Texas, has a bill to allow the government to accept charitable donations from individuals and nonprofits of soap and other things that these folks need. So my hope is that everyone can come together and not look at this as a political issue. Look, they need to reverse the Flores decision. They need to reform our asylum laws. Obviously, Mexico stepped up to try to control the influx of people that are coming in. Looks like this month's going to be much a lower number of people apprehended than it was the last 3 months. So, look, I think there actually are some encouraging signs in terms of that influx, but they've got to go further. We've got to do more. And the system is just being overrun. There's too many people coming in too quickly, and the system, both of our laws and of our facilities, is just not up to it. I do believe, having worked with the Department of Homeland Security, that these people are doing the best they can, but they need to do better.
Adrian, is there political will to change what's happening?
Of course, there's certainly political will on the Democratic side. I mean, look, this is a huge stain on President Trump's presidency, and it's a huge stain on America. This is something that is not sustainable. This is not what our country is about. I do think that there are some bipartisan efforts in Congress, as Matt just mentioned, to address the situation. But the fact that we even have to put a bill on the floor to allow for charitable donations to these children and families who are being contained in cages at the border is absurd, especially when you contrast that with the fact that Donald Trump and taxpayers are actually footing millions of dollars for his, big military parade that he's got coming up tomorrow in Washington, D.C.
Well, I want to mention that I wonder if either of you just very briefly would say that the politicians in this country are focusing on the wrong end of the pipeline. I mean, the president of Salvador said this is our fault that father and daughter drowned in the river. I mean, they are fleeing problems in other countries. And at one time, we had more invested in programs in Honduras, Guatemala, Salvador to prevent the violence that forced people to come here. Matt?
Yeah, I know, it's a great point. I think that actually the president made a mistake in cutting off foreign aid to those Golden Triangle nations. Mm-hmm. We don't need to increase their level of desperation that forces them to choose to come north across that dangerous journey. Doesn't mean we want to be irresponsible with taxpayer dollars, but obviously there's a problem in those countries. Look, we cannot accept every person who's poor across the world who wants to come in, certainly if they want to try to enter illegally. There has to be a system. On the asylum process, only 10 to 12% of those people that are coming here to claim asylum end up getting their asylum granted because they meet the threshold. So, and you don't have to come to the United States to claim asylum. You can claim it in your home country. You can claim it at a U.S. embassy in your home country. And hopefully you can claim it in Mexico soon. I think that was part of the negotiation.
We're going to be talking about this for a while to come, but I want to make sure we've touched on the Democrats and the 2020 race because, Adrian, polls are showing Kamala Harris surging, Joe Biden's lead slipping after her breakout moment last week. We all know she criticized his past opposition to federal busing to desegregate schools. Are the Democrats kind of in a hard place right now? Some are saying they need to have the new blood, but an ABC Washington Post poll out today says that 45% of people surveyed still say Biden has the best chance.
Yeah, look, I think we're actually in quite the opposite. I think we're experiencing the best of both worlds right now. We've got somebody like Joe Biden, who is a very experienced legislator that a lot of people still see, as the poll you just mentioned, still see as the best person to take on Donald Trump, the most electable, if you will. But we're also seeing this new slate of candidates, this next generation of Democrats, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, Beto O'Rourke. I mean, the list, Mayor Pete, the list goes on and on. And that's what I think is so exciting about the place that we're in right now. Look, I do think Joe Biden has got to have a much stronger debate performance at the end of July during the second Democratic debate if he wants to contain this reduction in the polls for himself. And Kamala, no matter where you stand on her issues, she won that night. That was her night. She owned it. So I think that if Joe Biden wants to, maintain his place in the polls, and he's still, hands and head and shoulders above the rest of the other candidates in the polls, but he is slipping. Kamala is surging, as are others. And I think if he wants to maintain that lead, then he's going to have to, recalibrate his debate strategy.
And there is a report out today that Joe Biden was able to pull in $21.5 million in second quarter fundraising. He only joined the race in April. This is second to Pete Buttigieg, who was able to raise nearly $25 million. I want to talk about Donald Trump. And Matt, maybe you can talk about this. Donald Trump and the RNC raised $105 million in the second quarter, a lot of it in small donations. That's a lot of money. What does it mean?
Yeah, and I think Democrats should be concerned about this. And there's not much they can do about it because the Trump reelection campaign is going to have this head start for a while. They're going to continue to be able to build up their fundraising advantage. $100 million cash on hand is nothing to sneeze at. I think they raised $20 million more this quarter than the Obama team did at the same time. And they're building out their organization. Part of the reason they do these rallies is they collect an enormous amount of data, not just from the attendees, but the people that request the tickets.
Yeah, $105 million in the second quarter. That's Matt Mokowiak, the Republican strategist, Adrian Elrod, the Democrat this week. We want to thank you both. It's just the beginning of 2020, but thank you both.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
The U.S. is continuing to support Ukraine in its ongoing conflict with Russia. The fighting is in eastern Ukraine. Last month, Washington said it would send lethal aid to Ukraine's military to help fight off separatists who are backed by Russia. This is as Ukraine gears up for a pivotal parliamentary election later this month that will help determine if the country pushes back on Russian influence and further integrates with Western Europe. Chris Miller is correspondent for Radio Free Europe. He's on Skype. Chris, you are right along the Russian-Ukraine border. What's happening there?
I'm in a small town called Stanitsa Luganska, and it's just a couple of miles away from the border with Russia. There has been a pullback of forces on both sides of the front line here. Ukrainian forces and Russia-backed separatist forces have agreed to pull back their men and heavy weapons a kilometer on each side of the line to create a sort of buffer zone in order to hopefully facilitate some peace in a city that has seen a lot of really heavy fighting over the last 5 years. But of course, the big question is whether or not this kind of brief truce is going to last.
So this brings us to the larger picture of what's going on in eastern Ukraine between Ukraine and Russia. Russia trying to keep Ukraine within its sphere of influence. There has been a tremendous amount of civilian casualties, a couple service people dying every week. It sounds from where you are right now like it's a fairly pastoral, quiet area. We can hear a swing set, I think, with kids in the background. So how is life continuing against this kind of backdrop?
The juxtaposition is alarming. Just to my left here, about 5 or 6 small children playing on a playground and two kids on a swing set. And then just over my other shoulder here is a group of servicemen. They're heavily armed, but civilian life has continued on. The routine typically here is quiet in the day and fighting at night. What is no longer, I would say, a very hot war, but a simmering conflict that has over the last 5 years killed more than 13,000 people.
What is the conflict over?
Well, Russia is certainly trying to keep Ukraine within its sphere of influence. While Ukraine, after a pro-Western uprising called the Euromaidan Revolution in 2013-14, set the country on a Western European path. And Ukraine very much so, especially 5 years after that uprising, is looking to integrate further into Europe. It's gotten a lot of support from its Western allies. The U.S. in particular is its biggest political and financial backer. Just in the last couple of weeks, the U.S. again has said that it will provide $250 million to Ukraine to better arm itself and equip its military in order to stave off any attempt by Russia and the local separatists that it controls here to take any more ground in eastern Ukraine. I don't want to simplify it too much, but Russia very much so is trying to use all levers possible. And that is not only conventional military means, but economic pressure and diplomatic pressure to keep it within its sphere of influence.
And to put this in the context of the parliamentary elections coming up later in July, several parties running. What are the stakes here?
I mean, the stakes are really high. It's nothing short of the future of the country and which direction it's going to be on. It's a parliamentary presidential system here. So really, the president doesn't have so much power unless he has a strong coalition or a majority in parliament. For the first time in Ukraine's 28 years of independence, it looks like we're set to see the strongest showing of one single party ever, and that is the party called Servant of the People of the current president, Volodymyr Zelensky. All polls are pointing to his party, which is full of new faces and people who have no political experience entering parliament in the several dozens, if not hundreds.
And do they veer more toward the East or Western relations?
Mostly Western relations. Some are actors who came up with President Zelensky, who is a former comedian and ran his own entertainment company. Others work to influence politics and are helping kind of create policies for this new president. There's another party as well that's led by a rock star. And together, if these two are to form a coalition, they could, in effect, control parliament to a greater extent than any party has ever before in Ukraine. And they will very likely keep Ukraine on a westward path.
So bring the United States in again here. The United States has just given a $250 million injection to Ukraine for armaments. These are armaments that would presumably be used against Russian forces. President Trump considers himself a friend of Russian President Vladimir Putin. What kind of position does this put the United States in, and to what extent does the U.S. have high stakes in the outcome of the upcoming election?
Well, despite President Trump's odd relations with Vladimir Putin and his statements regarding Russia, the United States policy on Ukraine hasn't really changed all that much. In fact, on the watch of President Trump, Ukraine has received lethal weapons. They got anti-tank weapons last year. They're about to get more lethal aid. This is not something that was done under the Obama administration. So the Ukraine-U.S. relationship is very strong. The people I've spoken with, including the president here, Vladimir Zelensky, said that he's been given signals from Washington that they are going to continue to back Ukraine. And he and his new administration are feeling very comfortable with the relationship with the U.S. at the moment.
Chris Miller, correspondent for Radio Free Europe, speaking to us from the Ukrainian-Russian border. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
COBOL turned 60 years old this year. Now, you may not hear too much about the groundbreaking computer language these days, but it's estimated that some 80% of financial transactions still use COBOL. That's common business-oriented language. As programmers retire, fewer are joining the workforce to place and keep COBOL programs running. But as Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav reports, COBOL's death has been predicted before.
60 years ago, COBOL was designed for those big wardrobe-sized mainframe computers. It was embraced and still used by many governments, hospitals, insurance, and retail businesses. Since it was created, the one constant in the history of COBOL is the prediction it was about to die. Even when it was still technically in development, its future was uncertain.
Well, less than a year later, there were rumors all over the industry that COBOL was dying.
That's Rear Admiral Grace Hopper in a video of a 1981 lecture. Hopper, nicknamed Grandma COBOL, helped create the computer language. After hearing the rumors, one of her collaborators went out and bought a granite tombstone.
He had the word COBOL cut in the front of it, and then he shipped it express collect to Mr. Phillips in the Pentagon.
The prank on Charles Phillips, a leader for the project at the Defense Department, was a turning point, she said. COBOL would go on to become the most widely used and longest-lasting computer language in history. The reason? COBOL reads a lot more like English than past programming code, says Mike Russell, COO for Frost Bank in Texas. older coding languages were math heavy.
I mean, if you look at it now, you'd have to know it's like learning a completely foreign language, but one like Russian or Chinese, where even the characters are different, right? And it's a mathematical formula in those characters.
For once, something was built for businesses, he says. Frost has around 30 apps still relying on COBOL. Other financial service providers still use COBOL because it's fast, efficient, and resilient. Companies can still embrace the new, like smartphone apps and better websites. COBOL's on the back end, Russell says. It's like an old car. While the seats might be worn and the body's banged up, maybe even embarrassing to look at.
So all the things that matter outwardly to me as the user, I can change for a large part, right? But I can't change underneath very easily, like the engine or anything else. As long as that's running, I may not need to change.
In other words, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. The cost for many companies outweighs the benefit. But with a lack of programmers to maintain those systems, the equation may change. Texas A&M San Antonio professor Robert Vinaja has been teaching COBOL for more than 20 years. And even back then, they were saying it would die soon.
Yeah, I mean, people keep saying that COBOL is about to die, and I mean, probably I'm going to die before COBOL dies.
Even though it's on the catalog, the course wasn't offered last year as the school shifts towards cybersecurity and more popular languages. PHP, Java, and others use a graphical interface that attracts students. COBOL can still fill a class, but...
The looks of the applications are dull. I mean, nothing fancy. Even in when I teach that class, I warn students that we're not going to create any fancy app, anything that they would be proud to show their friends.
Since COBOL's inception, languages like Basic, Ruby, and dozens more have come and gone, says Vinaja. But a lot of schools have stopped teaching it, and programmers continue to retire without replacements.
I'm 26. Besides myself, the youngest coworker I have is 40 years older than I am.
Sergio Montejano works for a financial services firm. He learned COBOL at the University of North Texas, specifically because of that need. He has job security, a good wage, room to grow. But he admits other developers often chuckle when they hear what he works on. But it's mission critical to companies, he says.
I think there's a misconception about it, a misunderstanding about it as far as it being old. Usually in technology we think because it's old, it's irrelevant.
Montejano says it's still the fastest processing language out there. Both he and Frost Bank's Mike Russell see the program going away in the next few decades. But for now, reports of its death are greatly exaggerated. For Here and Now, I'm Paul Flav.
Most Americans have become fluent in tariff because of the world taxes, in effect, imposed by the U.S. on goods from China. But the U.S. is also threatening more tariffs on the European Union, $25 billion, over a long-standing trade dispute with Airbus. Now, the U.S. accuses the EU of subsidizing Airbus, thereby hurting the U.S. rival Boeing. The EU, by the way, makes the same claim about the U.S. backing Boeing, but last May, the World Trade Organization sided with the U.S., and now these proposed tariffs, $25 billion, are being designed to be the EU's punishment. Let's bring in Seth Kaplan, transportation analyst for Here and Now. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Robin.
So the dispute between the U.S. and the EU, Boeing, Airbus, goes back to 2004. Remind us about it.
Yeah, in the aviation industry, Robin, it can often seem like everybody thinks everybody else is subsidized. That's true of many airlines, and it's most definitely true of these aircraft manufacturers. As you mentioned, this long predates this current new wave of trade tensions. It predates even the Obama administration. You go back to, as you said, 2004 under George W. Bush, the U.S. accused Airbus of receiving subsidies. Look, Airbus began as a European project, largely to challenge Boeing, and that's okay. The allegation by the U.S. is that long after it was viable, it was getting specific kinds of aid, grants and low-interest loans, those kinds of things that were illegal under world trade rules.
Okay, well, speak to people who are saying, well, we thought that happened all the time. Don't companies in the U.S. get tax breaks all the time? And in fact, in March of last year, the WTO ruled that the U.S. failed to stop some tax breaks to Boeing, that they felt unfairly hurt Airbus.
Exactly. Technically a separate dispute, but of course it's hard to talk about one without talking about the other. In Boeing's case, sort of less overt allegations of, as I said, grants and low interest loans, Boeing was accused of receiving unfair tax breaks, for example, from Washington State, Boeing, a huge manufacturer there, research and development funded by government from which it benefited, those kinds of things. And yeah, the WTO agreed with the Europeans in that case, that Boeing also illegally benefited from some of that kind of help.
But now the WTO is saying, siding with the U.S. and saying that it can impose these tariffs upwards of $25 billion as EU punishment. It may not be $25 billion, you know, it may be ratcheted down. But what does that mean? What will be more expensive? What will get taxed, so to speak?
Yeah, a long list proposed by the U.S., a lot of consumer goods, and you can sort of see iconic things like whiskey, Irish whiskey, as well as Scotch whiskey, pasta, cheese, those kinds of things that come from Europe. Also, other things that aren't consumer goods per se, like metals, a long proposed list. And the WTO will actually rule on what kinds of sanctions specifically the U.S. can impose. So again, very different here from when we think about what's going on with China, where the U.S. just kind of comes out with these lists. Here, it's all under WTO rules. It doesn't mean the U.S. has to do this. And in fact, Airbus has argued that imposing these tariffs would make things worse, not better, in terms of escalating the trade war. But the U.S. would indeed have the right to do that. And Europe, in turn, could gain its own right to retaliate with tariffs of its own.
Oh, boy. But I'm sure the U.S. would not be unhappy with putting tariffs on, let's say, bourbon coming from Europe, because it would boost bourbon from here. Seth Kaplan,
exactly.
Transportation analyst for Here and Now. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
It's tough to be a fisherman, and regulations that are designed to manage populations of fish are part of the reason. The government has imposed a quota system. That means fishermen have to pay to catch certain types of fish, such as cod. Cod is deemed to be in low supplies, so fishermen are only allowed to catch a limited amount of it. They can pay to lease someone else's quotas, and that way they can catch more, but that's expensive. One independent commercial fisherman in Maine is trying to fish more sustainably and make a living doing it. His name is Tim Ryder. Ryder is the founder of New England Fishmongers. We caught up with him in Littleton, New Hampshire in January. He was visiting one of his customers, Chef Adam Aldrin, at the Beale House Inn. Part of Tim Ryder's mission is to sell directly to the chef.
We own a business where we sell our fish directly to our customers, restaurants and consumers alike. It's my whole life of making this work. And what we've seen is when you cut out a lot of this, you know, tap dancing in between seafood, we're getting our fish directly to our customers 24 to 48 hours after they're caught. It's a fresh fish, the freshest fish they've ever seen. It's been showcased in Food and Wine magazine. Our customers have supported us and love the fresh fish. And it really has fueled my fire to keep doing this. The people believe in what we're doing. The fish is the best they ever had.
So, okay, I want to talk about how you managed to catch the best fish that some of these high-end restaurants ever had. I know that you hand-deliver the fish. As you said, you don't go to auction. You kind of get around a middleman. You bring the fish directly into the kitchen. You have caught that fish.
Yeah, the last stretch of days, I just fished 12 out of 13 days. And what we basically do is we take the best care of the fish on the boat that we can. We bleed our fish. We brine our fish. We make sure they're packed in ice. We work diligently at the quality of our fish. You know, the average fish that you go and eat at an average seafood restaurant has been around for 10 days and traveled 7,000 miles. We beat that by about 99.9%.
So you're kind of like the dairy farmer who delivers his own cow's milk directly to the house. When you go out every day, you have your boat, 36-foot boat called the Finlander, right?
We have Finlander 1, a 36-footer, and Finlander 2, a 47-foot LeBlanc.
And when you go out, how far out do you go?
It varies. We're scalloping. We're only 2 miles off the beach, but when we're hook fishing for pollock, we're 65 to 70 miles offshore. A little dicier on the 65-mile offshore ride.
How come dicier?
The weather. You know, you're in harm's way, and if anything happens, you're a lot further from home. And most people say we're crazy for taking a 36-foot boat 65 miles offshore, and they might be correct about that. But one of the reasons we do that is because we can't afford to catch cod. So we pass over fish that we could catch to catch other fish because the folks of the sector system of management has made us target species like offshore to stay away from cod, and it makes us risk our lives to do something that we normally wouldn't do.
So you're catching cusk and haddock and dogfish and monkfish, and as you said, pollock as well. But you mentioned something, when you get the fish in, and this is rod and reel, when you lure the fish in, supposedly you take extra good care of it. And what is usually done, and what do you do differently?
Well, rod and reel, and we trawl for flounders and monkfish. You don't catch monkfish on rod and reel. But with all the fish, we bleed our fish and we brine our fish.
What does the bleeding part mean?
Yeah, you hit the fish in a certain spot right in the aorta, and the fish pumps out all the blood. So you have no discoloration in the fillet. If you take a bled fish versus a non-bled fish, the color of the fillet is enormously different, right? It's very similar to hunters bleed their deer. It's essentially what we're doing with the fish. After the animal's done pumping the blood, we immerse it in a seawater and ice mixture to shock chill it and brine it and then layer it on ice. So we take the best quality of our seafood as, you know, fish as we possibly can, even scalloping right now. Like, obviously we're not bleeding every scallop we catch, but we're going through our scallops and we're rinsing them as quickly as we can in seawater, packing them on ice, really making sure we don't toss them around, bruise them, break the pieces up, and then gently getting them off the boat packaged to our customers as quick as possible.
So the result is, and I should say the bleeding part is a little bit unsettling to hear, but I suppose the fish are going to be eaten anyway. But the fact is that you're treating them in a better way. So this is what you have to do to try and beat the big guys, or at least beat the regulations, because you're not going to have much greater quantity. So you have to rely on quality. Is that how it works?
Yeah, I mean, believe it or not, quantity, we still have to wholesale some of our fish out. But we take a lot of pride in what we do, and what one of the benefits that the culinary world has seen is the shelf life. It holds up tremendously well. So he can serve our fish on Wednesday and serve it on Saturday, where the fish that's been around for 2 weeks that hasn't been treated that well, he's already starting to throw out. And it's allowed us to – we've had to do it to make it work, because when we tried to wholesale a lot of our fish, that our quality isn't – that no one cares. You know, and we get the same price as strip fish when we go to these places. And that's really hard because we aren't working on massive volumes. We do catch enough fish to service a lot more restaurants. It's obviously my sales pitch, you know. And that was our goal. And our goal was also to, with the business, is if I ever outgrew what I was catching, to be able to help other fishermen get the best price that are doing the same things as us, because others are looking at us for an answer. We saw historically the worst prices in New England ground fishing at the fish that had to go to auction this year that anyone's seen in 20 years. And local day fishermen, family fishermen paid the price severely, us included. And that's pretty shameful that, you know, where people are saying this, you know, there's not enough fish or this and that, or we got to go to farm raised fish and this, all these different programs that they have. But we have all this beautiful fish coming off the day fleet that we're basically throwing out or selling for pennies on a dollar, where people can't even make a living. And so one of the ways that we've defeated that, or trying to defeat that, is getting that fish as quickly as possible to our customers so they see the benefits of fresh fish. And the other benefit of this too is, you know, Adam and I were talking about this here, is that the local fisherman is talking. I've talked to Chef Adam on the boat a couple times over the past couple weeks while we're fishing. So these guys are connected with the product, like they're connected with the farmer that raises the produce and the beef and everything. They know who we are, and they can call us and ask us about what we're catching.
You mean he'll ask you when you're out on the boat what kind of fish you're catching, and then he can plan his menu accordingly?
He will, yeah. And a lot of these guys will call and see what we're doing and what we're catching, and it's focusing on seasonality. And we've seen a lot of people adapt to what we're catching. People that were traditionally didn't want to touch pollock, you know, have kind of had to force it on them and say, try this, please try this. And they've come back and said, it's great.
When you presented to them the pollock, wouldn't you say try it, meaning make it, or do you make something for them and say, here's a forkful?
I think a lot of our customers at our retail, I'd say, take this piece of pollock and take it home and try it and tell me what you think, because they're very reluctant, and they will take it home, and then they usually come back and say, wow, it was tremendously good.
And how much more can you charge for that than, say, they pay at the grocery store?
Believe it or not, our price off the boat are as competitive as the grocery store with the direct model, because there's not that many people making as much money in the in-between steps. So our price to sell Adam cod in Littleton, New Hampshire off the boat is actually more affordable than the bigger companies out here, which is crazy. And that's for direct, you know, fish right off our boats. So we do better by doing that, but there's not as much money made in the middle. And that's what's allowed us to really stay in business. If we didn't have this end of the business, we would be out of business because it didn't work wholesaling fish. I mean, as many trips that I've done with a beautiful hook and line pollock that you see in Food & Wine magazine, where we came in with 2,000 pounds of those fish and left with not even enough money to cover the fuel. We've literally wholesaled those fish out for 30 to 40 cents a pound and made nothing for fish that's considered some of the best fish in the country. So it's a direct approach. Is people think it's only for the rich and wealthy. That is actually very off from the truth completely. So we're pretty competitive to what's going on with grocery stores or bigger chains or anything like that. And it's just the direct way that we do it.
Business is good.
Business is good. Yes, business has been the retail end of the business has been enormous. We have a huge following. And we have more and more folks saying, we love what you're doing. And it's an old school way of doing business I'm really proud of. It's a handshake and a thank you to our customers from the people that do the job. And that's the fundamentals of what we've tried to do here. Know your fishermen, and they know. I believe 100% in what we're doing.
Tim Ryder, thank you so much.
Thank all of you guys for supporting us out there very much.
Tomorrow, Tim Ryder plans to spend the 4th of July fishing more than 30 miles offshore with his dad to get a head start on what he expects will be a very busy holiday weekend. He says they might even get to see some fireworks over the ocean.
Do you use those tiny hotel toiletry bottles? Or maybe you take them home with you, stockpile them? Have you thought about how much plastic that is? Well, California has. In April, members of the state assembly voted to replace small plastic bottles with dispensers or bottles larger than 12 ounces. If approved, as expected by the governor, the bill would go into effect in 2023, banning those little shampoo, conditioner, body wash bottles in hotels, bed and breakfast, resorts, vacation rentals. The bill is modeled after an ordinance adopted by Santa Cruz last year, which made that city the first jurisdiction in the state to ban small plastic bottles. Lynn Moorfeld is president and CEO of the California Hotel and Lodging Association. Lynn, how does your association feel about this?
The association is fully supportive of this. We worked with the author on this. Our guests want it. Our guests demand it. So we support this.
We do understand, though, that you asked for a little bit of an extension.
Yeah, correct. The timing on this was a little bit too steep for us, and we've got 600,000 rooms in California. And so swapping those out and make sure people can plan to put in the dispensers. We even have a little extra effort in there, another 6 months for the smaller properties just to make sure they can transition as well.
Well, you know, those little bottles, there's a thing about them, you know. You go to see, what is it? Is it the high end? They have a nice feel in your hand. But there is so much waste. Your thoughts personally about the switch out?
You know, the plastic bottles, you'll get all kinds of different opinions on them. Staying in a lot of hotels, I think I'm over them. that said, you know, everyone's got a little bit different branding on them as well, an experience for the hotel guest. And, you know, we market that to our guests, and our guests like that. When I tell my friends about this, they're like, well, wait a minute, I like the small bottles.
Right.
So there's definitely a whole lot of different opinions out there, but I think it's the right way to go
because,
in terms of sustainability.
But sustainability. Talk about that. Because a lot of the people we are reading about, the hotel owners and resort owners in California, are saying we only have to look to our beaches to see where those bottles end up.
Yeah, I don't know that you'll see small hotel shampoo bottles on the beaches.
Well,
I mean,
yeah,
you will see other plastic for sure, definitely. That said, a lot of hotels also currently have recycling programs with those. There's a program out there called Clean the World, which where you recycle those, and then all the product goes back to those in need. And people in San Diego participate in missions in Mexico as well. And a lot of people, I think everyone's got a drawer full of them at home. So people like them.
Well, I'm reading about Jen Hagloff, who owns a bed and breakfast in South Santa Cruz County. And she and her husband had long been donating all these little small bottles to homeless shelters. now they are completely shifting and moving to the dispensers. And it strikes me, too, that the thing that would bother you about the small bottles is you didn't use them all. So you were wasting doubly. You were wasting the content and you were wasting the plastic. Talk about the benefits of a dispenser. I mean, people can take as much as they want.
Yeah. So the dispenser, you've got follicly challenged people like myself who don't use a lot of shampoo. And then you've got some folks with some long hair that use a lot of shampoo and conditioner. So we have methods now to keep it healthy and sanitary. I know that was a big issue. You know, I kept being referred to as a health club dispensers, and no one liked the big 16 ounces in the health club. And these are a little bit different than those.
And as you say, you have liability issues, so there has to be some sort of guarantee that people can't tamper with it. But, you know, part of the bill would allow hotels to also replace the teeny bottles with big bottles. Isn't that tempting to people to take that bottle?
If they do replace them with larger bottles, I would imagine that a lot of those are going to find their way home. And I think that a lot of it probably on the larger size would probably be someone that specifically offers that amenity, a luxury brand, a boutique brand, and part of the hotel stay is a large bottle of shampoo and conditioner.
Which you can't take on the airplane anyway. So there you have it. We know that some hotels have objected. This is not cheap to put a dispenser in a room. I mean, it's refitting something. But in the long run, is it cost saving as well or not? Is that not part of the equation?
For some of the higher-end properties in terms of the quality of product that they're putting forward, maybe not. And there is the cost of dispenser, and you have to install the dispenser. And it's surprisingly complicated when it comes to operations and housekeeping carts and everything else.
And we understand that if a hotel is in violation, it would get a written warning, but then a $500 fine. First offense, second offense, $2,000 fine. But it sounds to us as if hotel chains are already moving in this direction. We know Marriott International already started this.
You are exactly correct. The industry was going there. So a lot of us in the industry said, hey, we don't really need a bill. And then we're looking at it and saying, okay, well, let's all get there together. And as long as it's fair and consistent, and we've got this all the way across the state, we're okay with the legislation. Just give us enough time to implement it.
Well, Marriott International, they started last year. They say dispensers have been put in nearly 500 hotels in North America. The average hotel will save 23,000 little bottles, about 250 pounds of plastic a year. Lynn Moorfeld, President and CEO of the California Hotel Lodging Association, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.